This is the Living Clean Podcast. This podcast is not meant to replace meetings, sponsorship, step work, or service. This podcast is meant to be another tool in your recovery toolbox. Our guests are here to share their experience, strength, and hope with recovery through Narcotics Anonymous. Thank you for joining us. All right, welcome back to the Living Clean Podcast. I'm Mason S. I'm an addict. We're back for another personal story. I'm going to do some introductions first. We'll start with the co-host, Francis.
My name's Francis. I'm an addict. It's a great day to be clean. My clean date is December 22nd, 1992. My home group is You Are the Book Book Study. We meet at 6:30 in the morning, and we're in Chico, California.
All right. It's my superstar co-host, Francis. Yeah. Okay. And then we will introduce our very special guest tonight.
That's you, Arnold.
I introduced myself?
Yes.
Okay.
Would you like me to introduce you?
No. It's just funny. I'm being really silly. Sorry.
Oh, that's okay.
My name is Arnold. I'm an addict. Arno. I got clean on November 8th, 1984, and I never felt the need to use again after that date. Well, I felt the need, but I never picked up again after that date. I also was just looking at a very old passport dated June 21st, 1977 was my very first passport. There's the young Arnold there. Too bad your audience can't see that.
Wow.
But I think I was drunk in this photo, probably. My eyes look really odd. And I haven't seen those eyes in a while. So I'm pretty sure there was something, some sort of substance coursing through my veins just to keep me up. I don't know, whatever. I don't know. I came into my first meeting in Los Angeles at a Thalians Hall in Cedar Sinai, and Thalians had a CA meeting that my friend David Lasley had referred me to, because David went there for AOA or ACA, and he said there's an AA meeting in there and there's a CA meeting in there, and he said the people in CA have got some really happy faces, you know. So you might want to consider that, because I think you're using quite a bit and you might want to find, you know, another avenue. And sure enough, a few years later, I took the information, and there was a 1-800 cocaine billboard in LA that I used, and I called the number, and a week later I went to my first meeting at Cedars, and it was November 7th was my first meeting. So November 8th, I took as my clean date. And I came into the room and I sat down, and there was a girl that I'd been using with. And she's a lawyer from Pacific Palisades, Jewish girl, lesbian. And, you know, I only used with lesbians for some reason. I preferred to because I felt safe. I had internalized homophobia and a lot of other stuff going on with me. And I just didn't want to use with, you know, the gay men that were around at the time. And I felt like I would either be used or abused or manipulated. And I just felt safer with these girls anyway. So one of these girls was in the meeting, and I said, "What are you doing here?" She says, "This is my second meeting." And I said, "Wow, this is crazy. One and two right here, back to back, you know." So we sat together and held hands and cried through the whole meeting. And I distinctly remember this Jewish girl who apparently lived in Beverly Hills, you know, sharing her feelings. And the emotion that I remember feeling was that she felt like she was never enough. And like she felt like she was always an other. So she was in school in Beverly Hills High School, she said, the bunch of white girls with blonde hair, shiksus, and she was just, never felt like she belonged. And she, that emotional feeling that I got was just so very real. And my gardener just shows up unannounced in the middle of this thing, and I'm going to have to pass. I'm not going to answer the door. So anyway, these emotions were real. They were very real, and the way she expressed them hit me hard. And I just said, "Me too, me too. I feel the same way. Like I can't seem to feel like I fit in, and I always feel like an other wherever I go." And now this could be attributed to me being queer, to attributed to me being at the time younger and black. And attributed to me being a musician or an entertainer, all these other things that I thought were just blocks to my being a full human being. So anyway, I stayed in that meeting, and I took some numbers, and I w went to another meeting the next day, and I really liked it. I kind of got the feeling that, okay, so this is where all my friends have been going. Where'd the party go? Oh, hell, the party's getting clean. So I started going to more meetings, and I went to AA because CA had no literature. They were just using the big book of AA. And I went to CA, I mean to AA, and I found my first sponsor. I heard a guy share. He was a gay man who had been married, had two kids, and was now in a relationship with another man. I don't know if he was married to him or not, but they were raising his kids, and he was a professor at Pierce College. I was like, okay, this guy's got it all. He's not pigeonholed at all. He's not he he doesn't he embraces the other. You know what I'm saying? So the other is the most important thing, I think. That I don't seem to be talking about today. I don't know what that's about, but that's what's coming up. I realized that working with this man that I belonged, and I felt like this program was going to change my perceptions and help me sort of get clean and stay clean. So I started working the steps with this guy, Al Redinger, from Pierce College, and I met some other people in AA, and I started creating a fellowship and a group of people that I wanted to work with and work in, and go to meetings with, And then I went to, and when I got 9 months, I went to my first NA meeting, and I got a key tag in NA, and it was a Monday night candlelight. It was, I guess, 1985-ish. And, it was at the height of the AIDS crisis. So a lot of these men were there in the meeting, supporting one another, sharing about, their struggles with living with the disease of, HIV, a brand new thing. So I realized that NA was a very safe space for me and to connect with these people. And sure enough, a year later, I tested positive, and I what is it, transverted, serotransferted. And I had this family, a built-in support system. Now, I know that I was a lucky one. Because oddly enough, I never got anything. I came in, I got all the drugs I needed. I became undetectable straight away. And I know that's not the case for a lot of people. A lot of people would get a test for an HIV test and feel like it was the end of the world. Feel like, okay, I'm going to go out with a bang. And there were a lot of friends I knew who died just because they thought that was what was going to happen for them. I assumed it might happen for me too, but I wasn't going to die. I wanted to live. So I continued to pal around with these guys in NA. There was a group of gay men and went to that Monday night candlelight, and then we went to some other days and other meetings and other days, and it became we had a meeting to go to every single day of every week of a, you know, of the week. And so I would have to say that those guys, and in that time in the late 80s, I was really supported and surrounded and loved. And we went to coffee after, and we went to the movies, we went out to dinner, we supported one of we had one of the guys lived in an apartment across the way. We had Thanksgiving at his place, and everybody did Thanksgiving at Ron Burns's house, you know. And you know, it was a really, really wonderful time to learn how to become community. And here we are again, which is community is the most important thing for us right now. And so I got this concept of what a chosen family is, you know. And Narcotics Anonymous and the men in the room were my chosen family. And a lot of the women in the room as well, for sure. So, oddly enough, I came in and I had been working all along. I was working with James Taylor, as you mentioned earlier. And in through the 70s and 80s, I was singing on all these disco records and jazz records and pop records and even the Ramones. I sang on the Ramones' Rockaway Beach. I sang on just all these amazing records. And the thing to do was to use while we were, you know, either at the end of the session, during the session, or maybe we'd start off the session that way. But, you know, that was how I lived. And to get clean, I kind of didn't get clean till I was 34 years old. Because it was just commonplace in the musical world. I started out in musical theater, and I got my drug sort of education when I was on the road doing the Broadway musical Hair. And that was in 1970 when I left Cleveland, 1970, and then I toured with Hair for 2 years, landed in New York, started pounding the pavement in New York, working and recording finally, and touring with Melissa Manchester first, Todd Rundgren, I toured with, and then James, and then Phil Collins, and then Lyle Lovett, and you know, and singing on all their records as well. So my repertoire was growing, and the kind of people that I was working with was, you know, ended up being really high end artists. And when I decided I needed to get clean, I was cocooned not only by that family that I shared about in Hollywood, but by my industry. There was James had gotten clean a year before. He was my example. Bonnie was getting clean. I think she got clean a year after. And I mean, it was just so many people were coming around and finding recovery in the music industry. So even on the road, we would me and Valerie Carter and James and Steve Gadd and a number of people would go to meetings. I distinctly remember gathering in the lobby of the hotel, you know, 30 minutes prior, and sometimes even the agent, Shelley Schultz, was the agent at the time for James Taylor, and Shelley would come in, and we'd all go to a meeting together. I distinctly remember a meeting in Duluth, Minnesota, and really cold, but we got in that basement, and we took Gad, and we took, I think Gad's son was sort of beginning to show signs. We took him to the meeting as a newcomer, you know, and it was just a really rich time in my life where the reason I stayed is because my community was there, and I created community. And I think it's really that important that you have people that you can sort of lean on at any given time of the day. Not just a sponsor to speak to or any of that stuff, but someone you can lean on any time of the day. Look who's calling me, this brother. They just don't know, do they? That we're busy. So anyway, it's great to have that kind of a community in the industry, and as well as outside in your, 12-step family. So my recovery family grew, and that first sponsor from AA died in my first year, I think. And I met a guy who was going to that Monday night candlelight that I would go to. His name was Sam, and Sam had great recovery. He worked at a recovery house, and I didn't know anything about recovery houses at all, really. I walked into the rooms on my own and with my own, pain and my own stuff, and nobody shepherded me in. I just knew that I was spent and that I was done. I'd been using for 20 years or so, and it was enough. It was really enough. So I surrendered. I waved a white flag. So anyway, that sponsor died, and then Sam carried me, and Sam and I worked together for a long time. He was working at this recovery house and called Cry Help in Hollywood, and Cry Help would run a bingo game on Saturday. So all Sam's sponsees had to sell pull tabs and daubers to the little old ladies in the bingo parlors. That was part of our, being of service. It was like just free labor is what it was. So I look back on that as an integral part of my service, understanding what service was, showing up, being there when I needed to be, and always showing up when I was asked to be there, Hollywood NA kept me clean. Hollywood NA was really powerful for me. I discovered the sort of the, I don't know if they were punk rockers, but they were some goth kind of vibe folks. And I gravitated to these kids. They always were black all the time. And they had lots of tattoos. And we went to a big meeting on Sundays. And it was Ron Athey, Tattooed Love God. And he was doing these really, really wild performance art pieces. And these were all kids being clean, but they had a club that was going on Saturday nights called Club Fuck. And one of the guys was a DJ, another one was, doing performance art in another room, but all in recovery. So, I realized that you can live whatever kind of life you want to live, just do it without using drugs, and do it with love and compassion for your fellow, So anyway, they became some of my really dear friends. Ron Athey and Juan Fernandez and Ellen Finitsky and all these cool people. Ellen, oddly enough, was at my first convention in Hollywood. There was the Unity Day, the first Hollywood Unity Day, and Ellen was the person who was chairing it, and she was outside the building to welcome me in. I didn't know where I was going. I sort of walked up to this place in LA City College and went to my first convention, and Pepe was the speaker. And I met his wife and heard him share. And I didn't know what kind of NA royalty I was hearing, but years go by and you kept hearing Pepe, Pepe, Pepe. And I said, well, yeah, I heard him when I first got clean. So it was kind of cool to have that memory. So Sam died, my second sponsor to die, and then I started working with my therapist, who was Sam had referred me to this guy for therapy. We went through a series of, therapy sessions, and I sort of stopped going. And then Sam died, and I said, "Well, who knows me and can maybe pick up the charge the way Sam knew me?" And I said, "Oh, Craig, who's a new therapist." And he was still working in therapy, but he wasn't my therapist anymore. And he was just the ideal sponsor because he really had the tools and really had the knowledge of, I mean, he lived and worked recovery, and that was his life. Craig was the guy who would go to, or he worked for the sheriff's department in California. And at his memorial, it was big, huge hall, and half of the hall was the sheriff's department. The other half of the hall was attics. So rarely would you ever see the two groups of people come together, except at the memorial service for a guy like Craig Perman Weissman, who was just, a leader. I'd say a leader in every aspect of the field. Cops and robbers, exactly. So Craig worked with me for a long time, and then he got cancer, and it was so bizarre. I was working with a guy, Mike Polin, and Mike Polin was working for the NA World Service, and we would go to lunch. We would go to sushi once a month, and we'd pick a completely different sushi restaurant up and down Ventura Boulevard, and we never went to the same restaurant ever. And we'd go to sushi once a month and talk about music and possibilities of the kinds of artists that would play, or that maybe I could sort of introduce him to do NA World Convention stuff. And he and Craig got the same kind of cancer in September or June, and they both died in September. It was just bizarre. Now, Mike Polin was the guy who wanted everybody in his room by his bedside. My sponsor, Craig, was kicking and screaming and hating this whole thing and really pissed off that he was having to live with this disease and had to take drugs for it. And, this was just completely not what he planned. And it was just, I got to witness how, two different guys with the same disease went out in two different ways. It was just powerful for me. Anyway, so then I met, I went to a memorial for, I don't know if this was after he died. Yeah, it must have been for his sponsor, who was sponsoring Billy Ryan at the time, Bob Raymar. Bob Raymar, at his memorial, I met Billy Ryan. And I knew about Billy. I'd met him at Ham's Memorial, and I met him at other places, and I knew about him, and I thought he'd be a good sponsor for me. But now I just lost three sponsors to cancer. Billy was in remission, and I think I may have told this story. And just the thought of him, I thought maybe I'd kill him. I thought I had the bad luck or something, the thing, the jinx. But and we laugh about it now, but because he's been in remission and is still in remission, and he was the right guy for me. So in my music career, I don't know, do I have time yet? Am I done?
No, you got time.
Okay, good.
17 minutes.
Oh, good. My music career continued through from before I used through my recovery, and I started finding my voice and making my own records and writing more, and not necessarily finding my voice as much as liking my voice, if that makes any sense. I the first time I heard myself sing in the studio, I just didn't want to listen. I didn't like it. It's kind of like a lot of actors you hear say they never watch any of their movies, it's just like to see this other person who is emulating you, who is actually you, to look at it. It seems really odd on some level. And so I had a good career in the industry, and my career got me to do more records and meet more artists and to tour more. I did three or four films as a singer on camera, not much of an actor really. I did, what were the films? I did American Hot Wax was my first film, which was Jay Leno's first film and Fran Drescher's first film. And in the cast of that movie was Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, Screamin' Jay Hawkins, Jay and the Americans. And actually, my friend Kenny Vance was in Jay and the Americans. He got me the audition in New York. So, and then American Hot Wax, Hollywood Nights, same director. I got to sing the song for the Warriors, Nowhere to Run, which is still like this weird cult thing the Warriors is a big, huge cult thing. And so 20-year-old kids know who I am. I think the Warriors was a video game even or something. So, all these films were really cool. I got to be in Beaches with Bette Midler in the opening scene. I was in a movie called Ralph Macchio. It was like the devil. So the character was Robert Johnson, and this guy selling his soul to the devil to, what was that movie called? But Bry Cooter got me that gig, and Bry Cooter's singers were me and Bobby King and Terry Evans, and we were in the devil's band. And we had this cool a cappella moment that I was a lead vocal of. It was just the best. What was that film called? Oh, it'll come. Maybe you can Google it. The Ralph Macchio film. The stuff was happening and my recovery was happening, and I never thought I wanted to go back to using drugs at all at any point. And I started working with people as a sponsor myself. And now I sponsor about 15 guys. I've sponsored up to 20 guys. I've watched guys OD. I've had my sponsees, come and go on many occasions. I've had a sponsee hang himself. He Crossroads, yes. Joe Morton was in that movie, and Joe Morton is just an amazing actor. And Ralph Macchio, and oh, that was when I met Stevie Vai. Stevie Vai did all the guitar work for Ralph Macchio, and Ralph Macchio had to pretend he was playing those licks that Stevie was playing. It was really an amazing thing to experience. Anyway, where was I?
You were talking about your sponsees.
I got a lot of sponsees. I got like 15 sponsees now, and I've got sponsees who've gone from being, pushing shopping carts to being like world-renowned artist. I've got a sponsee who moved from London NA to Hollywood NA with a small career, but is now one of the biggest, well-respected writers for film. And music producers for film, Trent Natticus, and I sponsor the guy from Bad Religion. Just outing everybody, I don't care. But Brett, and he's just like the sweetest guy in the world. He owns Epitaph Records, and so I've got this beautiful eclectic group of men that I sponsor. I sponsor one guy down here who's a therapist, another guy who went from nothing to becoming a doctor, Dr. Greco, who's still lives like he's got nothing. I can't tell his story, but he's moved down here too. And I just got this wonderful group of men that I love so desperately and so much, and they are my family, and they are the people that I depend on when times are tough and when times are even great. I shared last night in a meeting. It was a SPAD meeting, Spiritual Principles of the Day reading, and you just pick up a topic or a couple of lines, and maybe to read the whole thing, but I just picked a few lines from the SPAD reading, and I don't even have it handy, but it had something to do with passion and having passion for whatever you're doing. And the date of the SPAD was July 6th, if you have a Spiritual Principles of the Day meditation book handy. And it just talked about from passion to desperation. And you kind of live your life of passion the same way you lived desperately. That same energy that you had in the desperation, you move that energy to passion for your recovery, for your relationships, and for how you want to live your life. And there's a lot of passion that I feel for. I was really committed to the stuff that, the electoral stuff, and I was really into that and really, sort of rooting for one team, and my team didn't make it. So here I am today, living with a lot of my gay and lesbian and Latin friends and transgender friends, all these people being marginalized and being pushed away and being asked to leave society, leave the world, leave America, not being accepted as equal people. And here I am again in a fight, in this fight for the rights of people. So there was the fight back in the AIDS epidemic. There was a fight for Black Lives Matter. There was a fight for, for, when the LA riots was going on. I mean, as a Black man in this country, this is a continual fight. And now most white America is going, oh my God, we have to fight. We're all freaked out. Everybody's all freaked out. And I'm saying, where were you when all this other shit was happening? We've been fighting battles like this our entire existence. Some of you have been there, and others of you have been riding on the coattails of your race. It's very comfortable to be who you are, and it's very easy to be that. And sure enough, a lot of them are understanding that this is where community, once again, is vitally important. And so as a result, my friends are getting closer, we're getting tighter, we're checking in on each other a little more. And then on top of it was the LA fires. I lost so many musicians, so many artists, so many filmmakers, so many actors, and so many people who had just home studios in the Eden Fire in Altadena, or friends who had studios in the Palisades who lived there. I mean, I just lost, and a lot of friends lost their homes. And oddly enough, 2 weeks ago, I was asked to come up and share at the San Fernando Convention, and I got to sit and have a meal with one of my dearest friends who owns a case making company. They make cases for all the tours, they make cases for baseball teams, for the opera, for this is what they do. They make cases for anything. They make a traveling case for your big old hits. So no, July 6th, not the 26th. So yeah, they make cases, and anyway, they lost their home. And I remember when I met them, he was a keyboard roadie for James Taylor, or a drum roadie, I don't remember which, but and he met his wife on the road. And I, we used to use together, we used to write songs together, we used to do everything together. And I stopped, and they supported me, and they had a kid, and I'm the kid's godfather. And I got to sit with them and have breakfast with them, and hug them and cry with them, and had let them hear, explain to me firsthand how it feels to be with nothing. They ran out of their house with the shit on their back, and friends are giving them clothes to wear, and they're but they were laughing and yucking it up and saying, we were thinking about downsizing, but here we are. We're down, really downsized. This is the best way to do it, I guess. But and I called him another time, and he said he Jacko Jan the other day, and I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm going through the rubble." They were allowed to finally go through the rubble of their property because they were keeping everybody away, I guess, until the fires completely died down. And he said, "We're finding stuff. We're finding, wrought iron things and." It's just beautiful to hear him on the phone, excited about digging through his garbage and finding things. And when I went to that convention, I got to see another two or three sets of friends and family who had lost everything. And, thank God for the community. They were in a convention, they were there being loved up and asking what they needed, and telling their friends that they were going to be okay. Thank you for your love, and without it, we don't know what we do. And there was a girl who I didn't know had lost her house, and I saw her, and And I just looked at her face and said, "What's wrong?" She said, "I lost everything." And I just got to hold her for a while. And that's, what community is. And that's what it's going to be like from this day forward. There's going to be a lot of those instances where people are just saying, they're taking my this, or that they're my, my father's being deported back to Mexico, or I heard today that a person who's been trans for 26 years, all female parts, went to renew their license, and they said that you have to identify as a male because that's how you were born. So it's fucked up. It's just not right, and it's just out of hate and spite and no compassion whatsoever, and it breaks my heart. But this darkness that's coming to light in the world today and in our country today is making way for a brighter future. It's just making way for the light to shine. I didn't mean to raise my hand, but I did, didn't I? It's making way for the light to shine. And so out of the darkness, all these dark entities have come to light. And we can see them plain as day now. So they're out of the shadows, and they're just probably going to burn in the light, because they're not used to the light and the love. And there's a big, huge bunch of us that are all about light, love, and just hanging on for dear life. Anyway, that's enough of me.
Wow, that was fantastic. First thing I wanted to kind of ask you is, you're a very creative person. Obviously, you got to be very creative to have the kind of career that you've had. And you kind of alluded to, part of the scene and your music and movies and all those sort of things is, from the outside looking in, everybody just assumes that that is a very an atmosphere where people like to party all the time. So, as you make this commitment to your recovery and you get clean, did you see a shift in creativity? Like, I've heard artists share before that they struggled sometimes getting connected with that creativity, or did you find something new, something better, a new way to connect to that creativity?
I definitely found something new, and it was, finding my voice, finding different voices, finding my ability to record at home. I got the same mic and pop filter you're using, and I during the pandemic, that's what I got to do. I got to learn to record at home because there weren't any studio sessions, and everybody started. Well, everybody was doing it prior to this, but I'd always like to go to the studio and hang out in the studio and, be in the green room and studio snacks. I love snacks. But then I had to do this at home, and I started writing more, and I started learning how to, use logic and work on my own. And so, yeah, my creativity came through during the pandemic, but it also came through prior to that in making, I had made 10, 12 records now on my own, just solo records that I like. I like my voice. I will go sometimes, I'll go and listen to a little playlist of me. It's like, that's growth, and I have to say.
Wow, that's interesting. I can't stand, like, if I listen to an episode of this podcast, I have to fast forward through my part. It's like it's so cringeworthy, listening to yourself. So maybe I'll get there someday to where I enjoy
Sure you
listening to my
will.
own voice. Yeah. No, but that's yeah, no, that's great. I was so curious about, do you feel like you're a better writer, a better artist, and now that you're clean, or is there something that you couldn't quite connect to when you were still writing or singing while you were using, but you kind of touched on it. You got comfortable now. You're comfortable in your own skin. You're comfortable with your own voice. Yeah, so that's fascinating.
There
And
was a spiritual void when I came into recovery,
yeah.
and to open and acknowledge my spirit is like, it's just mind-boggling sometimes. For instance, to stand on a stage in full disclosure of my recovery and my health and my blackness and my whatever else I want to call myself, and just surrender to the spirit of me and know that I can carry that and present it to an audience and know the power of that and hear people tell me what you do is really relative, and what you do really shifts and changes the perceptions of people.
Wow, that's great. Francis, you got anything?
Oh, I have a couple things. You were talking about having sushi with this guy Mike that worked at the World Service Office, I think you said, or was on the board. And he was consulting with you about World Convention Entertainment. Did you ever hook something up for the World Convention? Does something play out that did you hook up Eric Clapton in 98?
I was there. I was at that. Were you there?
I was at that convention, but I didn't see the show.
Oh, the show was unbelievable. Because, I knew Nathan East and I knew a lot of the guys who were in the band at the time. I didn't know Gad at the time, but I think he was on the gig. But all these guys were there, and we did he when he sang Cocaine in front of all those addicts, I swear to God, it was like levitation. We were down here dancing, and then all of a sudden everybody was up here dancing. And it was just so real. But no, I didn't help him book anybody, but we would throw names around. I'd give him, managers' connections, and we aspired to have Bonnie, but she couldn't do it. We aspired to get James, but he would never do it. And I just, but it was about the sushi anyway, mainly.
Well, what ended up being your favorite sushi spot?
God, I don't remember.
You
I'm
don't
out
remember?
of LA, Katsuya, I think.
Yeah.
There's a place called Katsuya, I think, on Ventura that was really, really good.
Now you said you were in the Broadway musical Hair. Oh my God, I love that. I just love that soundtrack. And I don't know if I had the movie track or the Broadway track, but I just imagine being a hippie because I still aspire to be a hippie, and but the drugs got in the way of it. And so today, I guess, first of all, the album cover has the big hair. Was that you?
No.
Were you the big hair back then?
No.
No. Okay, just wondering. You're a member of the cast.
I was a member of the cast. That was really Jim Rado's head, I think. Jim Rado and Jerry Ragney. They were the two guys who wrote it. And I think it may have been just them or something, someone that looked similar to them. I used to wear a wig on the road because I didn't have a big afro, so I wore a rug. It was fun. I had a little short afro, so eventually I just stopped wearing the wig and would wear my natural. But I sang a chorus. I was hired. The story is I was in Cleveland, a gospel kid in Cleveland, and sort of not in the church much anymore, but just running the streets, getting high. And my friend who was running the streets with me said, he was a dancer. He had dance training, and he said, "I'm going to go to this audition, and you should come and bring a piece of music." I said, "No, thanks. I've never done that before." And he said, "Well, just do it. Just bring some music and sing for them." So I brought "Bridge Over Troubled Water," and I was the only black man hired. There were 200 people that auditioned that lived in Cleveland. Some other people flew in from Detroit, and there were four people hired that day, and I was one of the four people. I was written up in all the papers, and they hired me to sing Aquarius because my voice was similar to Ronnie Dyson, who was the original guy who sang Aquarius.
You sang Aquarius.
Yes.
Wow. I
Yeah.
love that song. Just the song, I think of all the time, but what I think about is it's the principles of Narcotics Anonymous. And but I couldn't be I couldn't be hair. Like I couldn't practice spiritual principles in addiction. Like, but I could aspire to practice principles now that I don't have drugs. Like that I'm not like this. Now I've been given like the hippie life, and those principles, that I've always, I'm like, wow, like all this, I mean, it was a principled movement, like with drugs, and it didn't work for me. But now I have all the principles in NA, and
It's in interesting how maybe that could have been the thing where I had this hair experience and then walked into the rooms of NA and heard the same sort of loving, kind, hippie style, feelings, when the, what a peace workers man, that whole thing,
I heard you talking about the struggle around the national climate lately, and there's a part of me that says I just need to stick to principles. Like I need to be the light. But there, I also struggle a little bit with, like standing up to what I think might be bullies or, and it playing out in the room sometimes is like, like hearing that kind of, I'm like, this is not there. This is NA. We have our traditions and like, so that stuff shouldn't come into the rooms. And I've witnessed it coming in. And, but that, like, I again, like, I don't know if I'm a part of the problem by just like trying to be as spiritual as I can, or like what is, I don't know what
Well,
it is.
the
And
truth
like
is.
I sit in a place of privilege, right? I'm like, I was born this way, like heterosexual, white, middle class male, like, but yeah. I do like believe in like opening the door, like to anybody that wants to come in, like in around the third tradition, like I aspire to the principles of NA as a guide to my life.
Well, interestingly enough, there was a guy who shared the other day. He's a black gay man in the army, and his job is to do diversity, equal opportunity, and inclusion. That's his gig in the army. So all of a sudden, the DEA thing falls down, and he's like, but I'm here working with white people in Hawaii who are the marginalized ones. And you just can't blanket that kind of shit, You never know who this marginalized group are, So in to, he's working with helping, say, white people, Howleys, in a native culture where they feel, less than. They feel like we need our rights too, So it's interesting, and he was just saying that all of this dialogue and all this verbiage has to change right away. And he says, I don't know what's going to happen to my job basically right now. But the other thing I have to say is that in that meeting, he was sharing about his experience. He was the lead chair for that morning. And then another guy jumps on and starts pounding political specifics. Now that's when it gets. It's not to be shared in an AA meeting. What he's feeling? Yes. What affects his recovery? Yes. But specifics about, the political climate is not to be brought in, I don't think.
Mason was
Yeah.
wanting in.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that's, we are fortunate that we have a fellowship that we can be a part of that focuses on inclusion. Regardless of what's going on outside of it. So we're all fortunate to have that. And I get what you're saying too, is that, there's people outside of that don't have the fellowship to lean on. So I'm glad there's people like yourself that will continue the fight and do what you got to do to make everybody feel a part of. So that's great. One thing I was gonna ask something. Oh, yeah. Of all your stuff that like you've done creatively, you mentioned some writing, Is there a piece of material or a part you played or a song that you sang or a song that you wrote that, God forbid something happened to you, like they could go and grab this and go, encompasses who I am. Is that piece of work out there, or do you feel like that's yet to come?
No, it's out there. It's a culmination of things, but I can name three things that I love so dearly. I did a happy birthday that I send to friends. It's, my own version of a, it's called It's Your Birthday. There's a song called Shaman that I did during the pandemic, which talked about sort of going into an ayahuasca ceremony, basically something like that. And talking about the person who leads the ceremony and the role of the shaman who leads that. And another song that I've always loved, a friend of mine made a ring for me, is called Love Will Prevail, which is kind of like the concept of what I learned in NA and kind of a hippie concept as well. Love Will Prevail. Those three songs, I think, speak to who Arnold is.
That's great. Oh, Arnold, man, it has sure been a pleasure. I've enjoyed every minute of it, and thank you so much for taking some time and coming on and sharing with us tonight. It
You're more
was
than welcome.
phenomenal. Yep. Francis, you got anything to wrap it up?
No, I'm so grateful to be able to spend this time with you. The first time you kind of came on my radar is a friend of mine that I do this history work with named Art Margolis.
Yeah.
He went to your 40 anniversary, and then he got me on the phone, and he wouldn't shut up about it. I'm like, he's like, oh my God, I just went to this thing, and like this guy who I've known about him for a long time, like he just went on about what a beautiful 40-year celebration was. And then you like Archer referring you and Peter to be a part of the Billy thing. I'm like, oh my God, this guy is going to be on the podcast with us,
Oh, crazy.
and we had just interviewed somebody just prior to you that got clean when she was 15, and I'm like, she's kind of like a unicorn in NA, and I'm like, Arno's kind of a unicorn in NA too, but maybe you're not, because you just described a whole bunch of people down in Hollywood that are in recovery. You're just the first one that I kind of came across, but like the stuff that you got to participate in professionally is kind of like the soundtrack of my life, I can't even tell you how many moments I've had with like listening to James Taylor, and this guy's like on the albums. This guy, we use it as like I was involved with theater, and we'd always play James Taylor before the plays, as house music. It's the ultimate house music. Yes, so like what an amazing privilege to have you here. Would you be pressured into doing something a cappella for us?
It's hard.
Or would you be okay with us potentially maybe splicing in
That
Love
would
Will
be preferable.
Prevail like as part of our intro to the
I would love that, yeah. Because I get all shy if I'm being put on the spot. It's like being asked to do karaoke. I've never liked doing karaoke.
Yeah. Well, this has been great, and thank you, Francis, for setting this up, and thank you, Arnold, for coming on with us. It was
Thank you,
wonderful.
Mason.
Yep.
Your accent is just the best in the whole wide world.
Thank you. Yeah. All right. We will be back next week with another episode. See y'all then.
Thank you for joining us on our Living Clean podcast. This is another platform that we can share our message of recovery, which is an addict, any addict, can stop using drugs, lose the desire to use, and find a new way to live. Join that no matter what club. You can contact us through text. The number is 931-306-9364.